You're listening to The Ones Who Succeed Next Gen Edition. I'm Campbell Barron, or at Campbell J. Barron on Instagram and Twitter. Welcome to the program. And today's episode is our first installment of the Next Gen mini-series within The Ones Who Succeed. And like the name implies, once in a while I'll have a conversation with an up-and-coming entrepreneur, leader, builder, or innovator, someone who's just at the beginning of their career, but someone I personally believe will go on and influence and shape our next generation. Today on the show, I'm thrilled to have a conversation with 17-year-old brain computer interface dev, among many other things, Luke Piette. I actually first met Luke through Twitter, as he's a graduate of the Knowledge Society, which is a 10-month human accelerator for curious and ambitious teens. And to give you an idea in regards to what type of kid Luke is, he recently posted a YouTube video featuring a brain-controlled drone he hacked together. This, of course, blew my mind, and his personal website, lukepiette.com, is full of personal projects he's worked on, including many web applications, brain-computer interface projects, and everything in between. Luke is originally from Toronto, but as of late August, is now based in San Francisco, where he joined this program via Zoom to discuss his origin story, his perspective on technology and innovation, his predictions for the future of tech, and of course Luke's personal ambitions in the coming years. This is The Ones Who Succeed Next Gen Edition. I'm Campbell Barron. My conversation with Luke Piette starts now. Luke, I really appreciate you taking the time to do this.
Yeah, this is sounds like a fun podcast. I'm excited. Let's get into it.
So this is actually my first installment of this like mini series I'm going to be doing once in a while called Next Gen, where I kind of talk to someone who I believe is going to be one of the next generation's great entrepreneurs, builders, leaders, thinkers. And you definitely came to mind. If you can kind of introduce yourself, who are you and what do you do?
Yeah, so right now I'm at Minerva, which is like an alternative university. And their take on education is, instead of, for example, Stanford, you're staying at Stanford, living there for the year for your undergrad, we get to go to seven different cities across the world. So the first year we start in SF for a year, and the entire program is online. So Minerva takes the best professors from all around the world, kind of pairs them with us, and then we have these small classes. There's only 150 people per year at Minerva. For me, context just on me, I'm from Toronto, Canada, and I just moved here last week. For the last few years, I've been really into neuroscience, understanding how the brain works, working with the brain, BCIs, things like that. So I started looking into curing Alzheimer's disease with stem cells like a long time ago. I was too young to like get into any labs or anything, so it was really difficult to push that forward. So I kind of parlayed that effort into a more technical field, which was machine learning, because it was connected through like, oh, understanding the brain. If you can understand the brain, you can, you know, do some great things with machine learning. So I kind of got into that. And that's when I started programming, building apps, which led me to work at a BCI lab in Toronto, where I was publishing a couple papers with some PhDs, master's students.
I'm just going to cut you off there. You gave me a pretty decent background in regards to what you do. You left out one little detail, which was your name.
Oh, Luke. Yeah, Luke Piette.
I first discovered you on Twitter, and I think I immediately checked out your site, and I thought it was really cool. But I thought your site was really cool because it seemed like you were on track to kind of become a great tech entrepreneur. But the big thread that I picked up on from you on Twitter and a bunch of other kids I follow, people my age I follow, was your time and experience at TKS, the Knowledge Society. And yeah, it seems like that was like a root thing you did in Toronto that I don't want to go as far as say it shaped you, but definitely had an influence on kind of your interests. So I have a couple questions here, but I guess my main one is, talk about what the Knowledge Society is for people who don't know what it is, and talk about what you took away from that experience.
Yeah, so founders of the Knowledge Society, one of them made a startup, the other one was working at McKinsey, and then after a while, they were kind of figuring out, well, what do we do now? Instead of focusing on solving a specific problem like energy or, you know, nuclear fusion, how about we instead train the next generation of teenagers to solve those problems? That way we can have the biggest reach instead of focusing all our time on one specific thing. So that's exactly what they're trying to do with the program. So it's a human accelerator where you walk in as someone who has ambition or someone who's interested in learning and wants good feedback on how to improve. And then they kind of mold your tech character, because it is mostly tech-based. We're trying to solve like hard technical problems. So I was in there for 3 years, and over time they've shaped the program a lot. So whoever's watching this could be years down the line, it might be completely different. But the first year, it was just kind of an introduction to different tech. The second year was more about trying to form logic in your mind. The third year was just building apps and trying to start a company. So it was a really cool variety. The first year, again, was just knowledge, absorbing a lot of knowledge on how tech works, this stuff. Second year, mental models. Third year, building. So that's a program.
Yeah. And am I correct in saying, that's actually a good segue, am I correct in saying you said in the third year you focused on a lot about building apps and perhaps tech entrepreneurship? Am I right in the sense that tech entrepreneurship is something you are interested in and or would want to pursue in the coming years, post-education, et cetera?
Yeah, for sure. Like I've always been into like being a founder, starting a company, scaling something. So I think through the program, they've kind of taken that ambition of wanting to start and grow something and then refined it with useful tools like knowing how machine learning works. So exactly, yeah.
And so what is it specifically? I'm just trying to break at this idea. What is it specifically about the idea of tech entrepreneurship that excites you? Because I've had many, you know, I've had talked to many, many, you know, world-class entrepreneurs. And there are people like Mark Cuban, who I've had on the program, who will just build companies over and over again. And so in your case, what is it? Is it specifically the idea of building a company that excites you? Or is it the idea of solving a problem?
Well, I think it's actually more of a, like, I see it as you can either adopt like a lot of responsibility in whatever job you do, or like little and get paid less. So like, you could either join Microsoft as an engineer and have, let's say, 1/1000th of the company's responsibility, or you could create your own thing, have all the ownership, and be able to mold it yourself. So I think on a subconscious level, it's
a control thing.
Yeah, it's a control thing. And like Mark Cuban, like I've never met the guy, but like, why would he keep making these companies? Maybe it's just a crazy obsession. Maybe he just loves the process. But I think also it's this idea of like, I'm creating something and I have power over it and I can influence the world. And he just likes recycling that process. So it's a similar thing for me.
Many successful entrepreneurs I've talked to are self-proclaimed control freaks. I've been told that I'm a control freak. I am very interested in this idea about starting companies, but not necessarily solving a problem. And there's this big debate I've had many, many times. I want to condense this, but I definitely want to touch on this idea of whether or not all companies solve problems. But before I get into that, to kind of lead us into that conversation, on your site, there's this really wonderful blog post. It was actually the first post that I read. And if you haven't checked out his site, it's lukepiette.com. I recommend you go read some of his posts. But the post is called How to Fail at Building Something Great. And so, interesting title. Can you break that blog post down a little bit, let's say in a minute or so, and then talk about what inspired you to write it and how it kind of relates to kind of the tough world of entrepreneurship?
Yeah. So I was in the process of trying to build an app. And before I got into it, it seemed super easy to just build an app, scale it, and then get like a ton of users. And then like, you're in the money. And then when I started building it and then like realizing, oh shit, like what do I do with this now that it's done? Like, how do I scale it? Why is nobody using it? How do I get users?
I launched, why did I not build it and they came?
Yeah, exactly. So that kind of ignited the want to write something about it. And it just kind of breaks through Peter Thiel's requirements for like a successful startup. And it's almost like just this checklist, like, does it do this? Yes or no. Does it do this? Yes or no. And, you know, reading through it after I've built a couple of things, like I can tell you all the things that didn't go anywhere were because they didn't fit that checklist. So,
and talk about that checklist then, if it has something to do. So talk about some of the things on that checklist that perhaps you're referring to here.
Yeah. So the first one is describe your company in 50 characters or less. If your company is too hard to explain to someone else, oftentimes it's not solving a fundamental problem or it's not easy enough to grasp. So that's the first one. Second one is, what is the problem your company is trying to solve? If your company is not solving a problem, most likely I don't have the statistics, but it seems like most likely your company is going to fail because it's not like
we'll get into that in a sec. That's like a huge point I want to talk about for sure.
Yeah. Describe the pain of your customer. How's this addressed today? And what are the shortcomings of current solutions? This is just kind of falling into the, what is the problem you're trying to solve? If there's no pain, then people aren't looking for a solution. If they're not looking for a solution, they probably won't use your thing. So why is your product a solution for a problem that exists right now?
So yeah, I'll stop you right there. Like we can go through these for a while, but I think we get the gist. But essentially, let me just, I'm going to paraphrase essentially with this blog post, the thesis behind that from what I understand. It's you basically, you know, it's very easy to kind of come up with a good business idea and build it. But if it doesn't hit those kind of points that Peter Thiel lined out, and, you know, I've also heard a few of those points from other entrepreneurs, respectable entrepreneurs. And one of those points actually is, you know, does your company solve a problem? And so I want to talk a little bit about that before we kind of get into your time in San Francisco. But first, do you think every successful startup, so not company, because there are Ponzi schemes that are companies, but we're going to avoid Ponzi schemes. Do you think every successful startup does fundamentally solve a problem?
Yeah, I've kind of thought about this before, and I don't think I've developed this thought enough, but I would say every successful company adds value. And then you can think about, well, what is value? Value is an increase in the likelihood of you achieving some goal that you desire. I mean, problem loosely defined is, on a fundamental level, in terms of goals, okay, objectives and rewards. A problem is when something is blocking you from attaining an objective. A problem is when I get stabbed and I'm going to die and I think, oh man, like this is a huge problem, right? Because yeah. I'm not going to live. A problem yeah. is when, you know, I'm trying to go to the supermarket, somebody cuts out in front of me and then blocks the way, I have to wait like an hour or whatever. That's a problem. So on a fundamental level, if value is anything that increases the likelihood of achieving a goal. So let's say TikTok, as an example, adds value to its users because it increases the likelihood that they will feel happy and entertained. So yeah. if that's a framework you could use, then you could say that every company must add value. And if every company is adding value, then it's solving some problem.
Yeah, I think that was very well condensed. And I would agree with you there. Coming up, I continue my conversation with Luke Piette. Stick with us. The Ones Who Succeed continues. We'll be right back after a brief word from our sponsor. Welcome back to The Ones Who Succeed in my conversation with 17-year-old brain computer interface dev, amongst many other things, Luke Piette. Okay, so I want to get into your educational journey in terms of post-secondary. For some context, education is something I've talked a lot about on this podcast. I've had founders of companies like Top Hat from Toronto who are in the education space. I've talked to people like Professor Scott Galloway, who's a podcaster, a professor, and entrepreneur, and is very vocal about the coming disruption of education. And I've also talked to many people in the program who have decided to go to post-secondary and have decided to go to a formal four-year education, and whether that's an Ivy League school or a college somewhere. I've talked to many entrepreneurs on the program who have also decided to not go and pursue a formal education. And I say not pursue a formal education because I would say that starting a company is one of the best educations you can get. So just to be clear in regards to that, everyone I've talked to has had some form of education, just it may not be formal. And this obviously wouldn't be a question if you wanted to be a doctor, but it seems like your interests are heavily surrounding the idea of tech entrepreneurship and tech innovation. What was the thought process for you in regards to the school you go to? What is the school you go to? If you can give me just a quick rundown. And I am really curious about the thought process. Why did you decide to pursue a formal or somewhat formal education?
Yeah. So I can give you an answer that's pretty and makes a lot of sense and aligns with me, or I can give you an answer that's more realistic. So the pretty answer is like, oh, I've always been driven by, like, you know, things that are unique and like unique programs. I want, you know, to meet people from all over the world, this stuff. So that's why I applied to Minerva. What actually happened is I applied to Stanford, I applied to MIT, I applied to Minerva, and those are pretty much it. So I got rejected from MIT, I got rejected from Stanford, and I was like, Minerva is a dope program. There's a reason why I applied for it. From one perspective, I wanted the like unique travel experience working with different companies all over the world. I wanted to meet cool
and
people
and
from
talk and just quickly. Part of the Minerva yep. program involves travel, which I have follow up questions to in regards to COVID. But yeah, keep going.
Yeah, so a big part of it is travel and moving from city to city every semester. So And these aren't cities across the US. These are cities across the world. So India,
international,
China.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So that was really cool. Versus like a Stanford and MIT, you're staying there for 4 years. The plus side is you get to develop like really strong relationships with professors or people who are into their field. The downside is you're kind of in the same bubble for, you know, many years, and you don't have unique exposure to the real world. So I wanted unique exposure to like, what are the problems that we don't have in North America or Canada that they might have in India or China or something like that?
And that is huge. That is actually so huge, because a lot of the key problems, $1 billion, multi-billion-dollar problems, have been solved in the US and Canada. And
yeah,
of course,
exactly.
There are more opportunities, obviously. I think there's no shortage of opportunities, but there are just so many immense, huge problems in developing nations all over the world,
yeah,
that I think, and developed nations just that aren't in North America, that I think kind of are worth paying attention to.
Yeah. So that's part of it too. Like, I'm sure in India, where there's, you know, a lot less development, and this is just, you know, reiterating, there's a lot more opportunity. Yeah.
And so why did you decide to even apply to college? I definitely don't think a college degree is mandatory for any entrepreneurial success. It does seem like, though, you are more interested in kind of hardcore innovation as opposed to kind of just building an app. But why did you decide to apply to college in the first place?
So yeah, I do know a couple of people who have gone the other way, and it's worked pretty well for them, for some of them, for others, not as well. So I could either, my options were this: I was going to take a gap year and then see what happens, and then take another gap year if things worked out well. But when I got accepted, I just decided to go for it because I got that unique experience. So initially my thought process was I can either, one, stay in Toronto, and I was going to take the gap year, and then, you know, just do like a ton of like cold emailing, reaching out to people, figuring out like what company should I work at, where can I make the most money, where can I, like, you know, provide a lot of value at these companies. Mm-hmm. But I felt like I'd already, like the fraction of Toronto that I know is very small, but it had felt like living there downtown, meeting with people from like Fastkin, like Shopify, like these big companies, I already kind of understood the tech scene there and wanted different exposure. So I could have done this too. I could have moved to another area like San Francisco, and that's what I was going to go to during my gap year, if I was going to take a gap year, and then just like grind and like do stuff there. But then I was thinking, okay, if I'm moving to San Francisco anyway, not staying in Toronto, and I just got accepted to Minerva, let's say, because I was applying just for the sake of it, then may as well just go and then have an like a warm intro to all these students who are literally like the top 1%. The acceptance rate in Minerva is like 0.6%. Like, these are the top students from all over the world. So why miss that opportunity and just like grind in SF when I could, you know, meet these students? And in the back of my mind, like between me and you, I was also thinking, worst case scenario, I go for a year, it doesn't work out, I drop out and like stay here or something. So I wasn't bounded to this like university. It was just something that made the most sense.
Yeah, I think that's a very strategic decision. And what I like about it is it's very personal to you. Yeah, you didn't decide to go to Minerva or not go to Minerva because your parents, or maybe I'm sure your parents influenced it, but because your friends or everyone around you was doing A or B. And I think that's kind of the big thing. I have no strong opinion on college other than the fact that everyone should go to college is ludicrous. And the idea that everyone shouldn't go to college is also pretty much ludicrous. And so I think there's a balance. But I want to talk a little bit about something here that you kind of subtly mentioned a couple times. You mentioned that there's travel taking place in regards to your program. And how does COVID affect that? Because COVID, if your program is centered around travel, COVID must have some dramatic influence, I would assume.
Yeah. I mean, it had a huge influence. So right now, for the M24s, which is the class graduating in 2024, or like theoretically graduating, we're at, I believe, 30% capacity. So it's about 30% of people who are here at the residence in San Francisco, and 70% of people who are just taking the same courses from home and doing more of an online thing. So it influences that a lot. The nice part, though, is because only 30% of the first years were able to stay in the dorm, the year two is the year, three is the year, four is that had been there for a couple of years are staying floors below us. So now instead of just having exposure to like all the first years, you have second years, third years, fourth years who have done more projects, worked on more companies, have more experience. So that's the positive side. Best case scenario, by January, when second semester starts, or February, everybody comes back to the residence and then we have full capacity. Everybody's here. It'd be awesome. But worst case scenario, like it might drag on till next year. And then that would be even more problematic.
And so at this point, you're not doing any traveling?
No, like we're actually technically in soft quarantine. So we're allowed to go to the food market, buy stuff that we need, but we're not supposed to interact with strangers, do things like that.
That's crazy. I think right now the big thing is the race to kind of find a vaccine. And I definitely want to talk a little bit about that towards the end here. Now, I'm really interested in kind of this idea of discovering like the next major platform shift or next major interface. So we had touch and like the mobile boom, right? And that kind of presented a huge wave of just kind of consumer social apps and just, you know, mobile business B2B apps, etc. Then I, you know, have talked to people who think voice and platforms like Alexa or Google Home will be, you know, kind of the next major platform shift. And you seem to be very fixated and interested on this idea of the brain-computer interface. This could get pretty technical pretty quickly, and so I don't want to scare away any listeners who aren't super interested in the nitty-gritty, but I want to hear your thoughts as a brain-computer interface dev. And for some context, you know, on your spare time, you built a drone that can be controlled via the brain, and I thought that was very, very gimmicky, but awe-inspiring, like a nice, healthy mix of the two. What are your thoughts on Neuralink, and how viable is an idea like Neuralink? On the spectrum of completely gimmicky to, like, this is going to change the way technology interacts with humans.
Yeah. So the whole field of neuroscience has been pretty frustrating for the last 30 years, even 50 years. Like, we haven't made that much significant progress. Neuralink's approach is a more centralized one. So what often happens is you have all these research labs in different places around the world working on specific things, niche things that they find interesting. But most of the time, these researchers or professors are working on projects that they think are kind of cool, or like most of the time they're pretty gimmicky. They're not actually applied to solve a problem or something like that. So Neuralink's approach is more of a centralized one, where instead of having a bunch of people who are scattered all over the world doing BCI research, let's get the smartest people together in one room, figure out how we can make like a commercial implant that anyone could get, and then like make some magic happen, basically. Mm-hmm. The technology they're using today isn't revolutionary. It's like been used before. The wires that they're using isn't like crazy, like insane. It comes from labs, but their progressive development in terms of streamlining the process of building these things. So like the robot they built that can insert the wires into the brain is like super cool and saves a lot of time. Instead of having a physician do that, they can just have the robot do that. But like fundamentally, I don't think we'll get that far in BCIs until we have a really good grasp of how the brain works, and not just mechanically, but almost on a philosophical level. Like, we still don't know what consciousness is. We still can't really put a finger on what anger or happiness or joy is. So the idea with Neuralink is, let's get there through tech application before we start thinking philosophically about this. And along the way, we'll figure out, okay, well, if we do this, this happens. And by making it commercially available, it'll incentivize more people to get into the field too.
Yeah. All right. So this is, you know, a segment I'm probably the most excited to do. I've been looking forward to this for the entire interview. So we started this interview off by kind of talking about you, Minerva, your entrepreneurial journey, and I definitely have some more questions about that, but I want to make some predictions here. And I think what makes the next gen series in this first installment so exciting to me is the promise of looking back in 5-10 years. And, you know, whatever you've ended up doing, whatever I have ended up doing, we can kind of look back and say, oh my God, we were so right or so wrong. And so I have a bunch of topics here in what I believe to be an order of importance. Obviously, that's subjective, but I think it's kind of irrelevant. I want you to make a quick prediction in regards to what happens. And I'm going to make a quick prediction in regards to what I think happens. And then we'll move on and kind of make our way through these topics. Does that sound good? Okay, cool. So first one, is mobile still the dominant interface? This is 5 to 10 years. Has the brain-computer interface taken over, or is voice, you know, maybe smart speakers, is that kind of a major platform and interface shift? What are your thoughts?
I would say based on the last 10 years of Apple not really doing that much in terms of innovation there, mobile is still very prominent. You're probably going to see, well, it depends. Are we saying 5 or 10 years?
Yeah, let's say in between 5 and 10. So you can lean towards 10 on this one.
Okay, so I think leaning towards 5, I'd say mobile is still prominent. You're seeing very wealthy people who have developed implants. I think wearables are going to be a much bigger thing than they are today. Data, recording data, having companies have access to your data and draw implications based on your biometrics. I think that's a bigger thing.
And when you say more wealthy people have implants, are we talking about brain implants, like computer implants and into human body parts?
Yeah, I'd say the most sophisticated implants would be predominantly owned by wealthy people, but I think there's still going to be a branch of, like, Elon wants to make his implants like $3,000 or something, which is not that much. So it depends. I think there'll be private companies that come out that want to make like a very specific advanced implant for billionaires, let's say. And I do think billionaires and very rich people will have more interest in the field. So people who were just doing real estate before, let's say they were huge real estate owners, billions of dollars. Now they're going to look into, okay, I'm getting old. How do I still live past, you know, 90? And then that there's going to be a lot more push in the longevity field. So I'd say by 10 years, you have, like David Sinclair is already talking about research that shows you can double the lifespan of mice with, like, I don't think it's injectable. It's just a supplement that you take, which is like insane. So 5 years is basically this, but on a lower scale and still in development, more privatized, not that public. 10 years.
10 years. Start with Apple. Start with the mobile app store. Is mobile still our dominant interface?
Apple pivots to wearables and tries to get into the implant business and connecting implants with mobile.
Interesting. Very interesting. That is a bold prediction that I'm looking forward to checking back on. I wouldn't discard voice. I don't know if that's Echo or Google Home, but whether it's a new smart speaker, I don't think it's going to be a complete platform shift, but I think you're going to start to see ambient voice kind of rise in prominence. I think the App Store is probably still going to be around, just not as popular as it once was. I don't think we've hit the peak yet, but I think in 5, maybe pushing towards 10 years, I definitely think that we would have passed the peak at that point. But I could be wrong. I mean, we all could be wrong. But, you know, BCIs, I have zero knowledge in regards to this space. So whatever Luke's prediction is, I'll go with that. I do think, though, like many things, most tech breakthroughs start as privatized and expensive. And then kind of as the cost of development goes down, you tend to see more people kind of take part in the hype. And so we'll see what the next major interface shift is. Coming up, The Ones Who Succeed continues. We'll be right back after a brief word from our sponsor. Jose Sotelo was the co-founder of Lyrebird, an AI startup working on software that enabled anyone to clone their voice. And in 2017, Lyrebird's profile was on the rise. They participated in the Y Combinator program in Silicon Valley. This was followed by millions of dollars in investment from top-tier venture capitalists like Andreessen Horowitz. However, like any startup, Lyrebird's journey was filled with high highs and low lows.
This kind of technology really creates an emotional impact on people. Like, you get scared, like when you realize like what could happen if someone could copy your voice.
Why the business of synthetic voices just isn't as straightforward as it sounds is discussed on episode 17 of The Ones Who Succeed, featuring Lyrebird co-founder Jose Sotelo. Listen on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your shows. You're listening to The Ones Who Succeed in my conversation with Luke Piette. Welcome back to the program. So we're going to jump right back into this conversation. Number 2, the education system. Does a college degree still hold value, or have boot camps and backyard pods taken over?
Yeah, so I think the concept of college might be like one of the main value adds of a university like Stanford or an Ivy League is the filtering mechanism. So I think there will be less expensive, more accessible filtering mechanisms that are equally effective. So for example,
interesting.
Yeah, instead of having to pay, you know, $80,000 Canadian to go to Stanford every year, you might have this like institutionalized exam or thing or like program, kind of like TKS, where, you know, you have lots of applicants, but a very small amount get in and it's not that expensive. So I think there'll be a lot of private education systems that are pushing their own thing, and the value of the degree will drop as the value of your portfolio increases.
So I love that prediction.
So instead of looking at, you know, where are you from, it's more about what have you done. Even, you know, if you're 10 years old, you can maybe get a job at Google or Microsoft based on, you know, what you're working on.
I love that idea. I do think the value of the portfolio, and I genuinely hope that the value of the portfolio far surpasses the value of the credential. It's a very Silicon Valley idea not to go to college and to start your own thing, or even get, I have a full-time job now. I don't have a college degree. And I say that with immense privilege. That's a very technology kind of media centric idea. And, you know, if I want to work at Goldman Sachs, that probably wouldn't be the case. So I do hope that more kind of formal institutions look beyond the credential. I do predict that the value of the credential will go down. I predict, like you mentioned, the portfolio will go up. But I also predict we're going to see a bunch of kind of still important but less formal education boot camps, kind of how you see Y Combinator and Techstars and even the TKS, the Knowledge Society. The real value is the experience. Y Combinator does have now a credential, but still the value is the experience. And I do see that kind of taking shape in other fields. I think what Lambda School is doing with kind of programming boot camps, where you kind of, you know, have to pay and, you know, give a percentage of what you earn, is really interesting. So I think there'll be a wide range of educational learning opportunities. I do predict that the coming disruption of education is like right now and is happening, and COVID has accelerated that.
Let me just add one more thing. I think that now that portfolios are valued higher, this is 10 years down the line, you're going to have private companies that actually validate the portfolio of people. So like these companies, like let's say TKS is going to hire a private company to validate, because it's super easy to fake things. You could say, I did this for, you know, whatever. I did this. But until you get in the interview room and you can show that you've done something.
Right. So you're just not completely BSing your way through saying like, I was the third employee at Facebook.
Yeah, exactly.
Very smart. Very smart. True. And people fake, you know, university credentials too, and they get in trouble for that. So now, this kind of leads into a topic that kind of influences our lives, feels so heavy at this point. Coronavirus, in 10 years, okay, do we have a vaccine? And that may sound like an obvious yes, but more importantly, the real question is, what habits that we have formed during the lockdown, during this quarantine, stay the same, and what habits disappear? And when will life go, quote, and I'm, you know, air quoting here, back to normal? What are your thoughts, Luke?
It could be that I think 95% chance, 99% chance we're going to have a vaccine for COVID-19, but we might not have a vaccine for COVID-26, 27.
Oh, God.
So it might be the case.
I hate that idea.
It might be the case that these groups of viruses like COVID can develop so quickly that it's just really difficult to keep up with them and to keep creating these vaccines. So, okay. On the optimistic side, here's what happens. You have a more streamlined process of creating vaccines. There's less regulation or less strict regulation when it comes to finding these vaccines.
Yeah,
exactly. And it's just, you can cut the process down to like, hopefully by 75%, and it doesn't take 2 years. It takes, 6 months. So I don't think COVID-19 is going to be the big thing in 10 years, but I think that we've all kind of woken up to this idea that biological warfare and
pandemics can occur now.
Pandemics can occur. And like, we've just been super lucky in the past like 50 years. I don't know why it hasn't happened before.
And apparently going back, doing some research, there have been some close damn calls. Like there have been other kind of flu kind of from wherever that have actually like gotten traction, but killed too many people too quickly so they couldn't spread, or just wasn't harmful enough, etc.
Well, Ebola was a scare. It just wasn't, it didn't spread as quickly.
And it also wasn't here. Like there wasn't major breakouts in North America. There were like a couple one-off cases. But my follow-up question to kind of just this entire like COVID, focusing on COVID right now, what habits do we take away from this experience?
Yeah. One of them is like our perceived value in human-to-human interaction as like a necessity has gone down. So for business, for, you know, things like that, like we've kind of woken up to this idea that like you can still operate your job from home. You don't need to be in person all the time. And like employers can pay you much more if you work from home because there's no real estate cost. So like that's one aspect that I think will change a lot. I think working from home versus working from the office will be more of a preference than a necessity. So you'll have the choice of being paid more to work from home, or, you know, maybe if you're in the city and you like the environment, you'll be able to work in the office. Actually, that might create like a dynamic between, oh, you work at Google, do you work from remote or do you work in the office type of thing? Where maybe people who work
it's a default.
In person.
Yeah. Because work from home, like let's remember, work from home pre this was like, do you work from home? Like, how do you collaborate? You know, people did it, but it wasn't super socially accepted.
Yeah, exactly. And like as more apps and platforms develop that lower the friction of working from home, I think it'll just keep growing.
Yeah, I think you pretty much touched on it. And I mean, to add to you and for my prediction here, my prediction is that 50% of the people actually never return to an office. And, you know, there are a lot of smart people who are going to disagree with me. So, you know, everyone's entitled to their own opinion. But I do think that there are just so many people who have had an awesome, positive experience working from home. I know many that it's just going back to an office seems like a different world, even when everyone else is back. I don't think this is the end of the office. In fact, this might even validate more of a WeWork mantra where the big corporate headquarters where everyone works may not be as viable, but, you know, companies will have, you know, desks that they rent for employees who kind of want a collaborative space that they can go in once in a while, or some people might work from an office, but it'll kind of be micro establishments and the team is predominantly remote. Shopify has pivoted kind of towards a remote first work environment like they talked about. Google said employees and Facebook and Twitter, like all these tech companies are kind of leading the way for remote work, and, you know, they have clearly have very flexible plans. But I think that part of COVID might permanently change. I do think, you know, people will eventually fly again and travel again and go to concerts again. You just can't not. And I think it'd be a shame if that never occurred. And it also caused some major economic and social destruction. So those are my coronavirus predictions here. And then number 5 out of 6 on this list here that I'm looking at, will SpaceX, or anyone for that matter, have A, gone to Mars, or B, colonized Mars, or C, at least sent someone to Mars? I'm going to put this in out for 10 years because I'm not sure in 5 years if this is kind of likely. So in 10 years, will SpaceX have sent, colonized, or gone to Mars?
I think sent a rocket to Mars is like they're pretty close today. Like,
what about humans?
I don't know if this is true. Humans?
I think in 10 years, in 10 years, is Mars going to be like, I'm going to do a business trip in Mars? No. But are we going to have like, is the colonization of Mars something that is kind of in our near future?
Well, Elon Musk is, I don't know, from interviews, talks, it seems like his timeline is like the timeline is too long for his lifetime. Like he's been saying that based on like our progress, we really need to speed things up or else we won't get to a point where we colonize Mars before I'm dead. So that seems to me like if he's expecting to live to, let's say, 85 or 90 or 95, that's like, you know, 40 or 45 years. That's his own prediction, the guy who runs the company, not like some kid who just like reads a couple articles. So I'd say
I have heard that SpaceX has the ambition to send someone to Mars by 2024, although I don't know how viable that is. But colonize is totally different from like a little trip. Or, I mean, it'd be a huge trip, but colonization is different. So, yeah. So what are your predictions in regards to this?
So I wouldn't be surprised at all if they have a person who's gone to Mars by 2030, but I would be extremely shocked if they had hundreds of people who've gone to Mars. I think it's a really early stage development in 2030. And then getting into 2040, you might have, you know, a couple dozen or a couple hundred people living there. 2050, hopefully you have more development, but I don't think in the next 10 years you'll see a lot of development there on Mars.
Yeah, I would say I don't see a full colonization in 10 years at all. There's a lot of work to kind of make that viable and safe and hopefully prevent any potential accident.
To be fair, I know at the start when Elon was like starting the company, he was talking to physicists and rocket scientists and they were saying, no, there's no way you can build a rocket that can land itself. Like, this is like crazy.
You know what?
Difficult.
Fair. Yeah. Now, The last, and I put it at the last one because it's probably the biggest problem that I see, and I hope that we can kind of get our grasp around. Where is climate change and the climate crisis in 10 years? Now, 10 years, I'm going to say 10 years, 100% 10 years I'm saying this, because I've, you know, 10 years is kind of the time, or 12 years is kind of the time we have to kind of slow and or partially reverse climate change. So in 10 years, what is your climate prediction? And I'm not really referring to protest. I'm really referring to kind of technology innovation and how we kind of look at this.
Yeah. Until we find an energy source that's more effective than fusion, I think fusion is just going to be like, okay, if we can make enough development in the field of fusion where you have these compartmentalized, like basically reactors that could fit in your home and generate enough power to power your neighborhood or your block or like your even, you know, your small town. If we don't make enough progress and can't build these reactors that are super accessible, then we're going to see a lot of problems. But if we can find an energy source that can trump solar, because solar is just a secondary, like you have fusion, which is taking the energy directly from the sun or like the same processes that the sun does. And then solar is like, you know, a byproduct of the sun, and it's way less condensed. So I don't see solar being a big thing in the next 10 years. Like solar is not going to take over the world. The only energy source that I could see taking over the world is fusion. And if that is the case, then we might be fine and we'll see, okay, well, maybe electric is the new thing and most cars are electric now. And there's like more bans on gas powered vehicles. Like I hope my grandkids are saying, what the heck, you guys used to burn like gas and then
and there's those like footage of these like coal power plants going up and smoke and, you know, emissions coming out of vehicles. I hope electric is something interesting and is something kind of beneficial.
But like I wish the efforts of all the protesters went towards like building tech instead of protesting government, because the government's one of the
least innovative, slow moving. Completely. I agree. Yeah. All right. My last question for you, where do you see yourself in 10 years? And what is your ambition for your career, for your work, for your personal life in 10 years?
Yeah, this is I'd say even more difficult question to answer, because you could have a net worth of, you know, let's say $100 million, but you've done, you know, a variety of things. Knowing where I am in 10 years means I know what I took to get there. Like it could be the case that maybe 5 years down the line, I'm like, hey, you know what? Like brain stuff is really cool, but like maybe I just want to settle down. Like maybe I just want kids or something and like live in, I don't know which city, like still live in a tech hub, but not be as implicated, just be an angel investor or something. I don't think that's the case. Like maybe that just makes me the most fulfilled down the line. So I'm gonna respectfully refuse to answer the question because I don't know.
Respectfully refuse to answer the question. Fair enough. And I'll allow you to respectfully refuse to answer the question as long as when you're starting your first thing, you call me and I could figure out a way to make some form of angel investment.
Yeah, we'll see.
Luke, I really appreciate you taking the time to come on the program. Awesome to get to talk to you. Wish you best of luck and continued success. And thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
That's Luke Piette on the Ones Who Succeed Next Gen Edition. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, it would be amazing if you could leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. It really helps us out. Or why not tell a friend? That also helps new listeners discover the show. I really appreciate it. If you want to see clips from the show and stay up to date with what I'm working on, you can follow me on Instagram and Twitter at Campbell J. Barron. And you could find this podcast on YouTube. Our channel name is The Ones Who Succeed. You've made it to the end of the show. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Campbell Barron, and I'll be back in no time.